morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Peter, you're going to tell us a lot about your little play date with wine in California.
Yeah, we had a little adventure to a wine region that's very well known, but which we hadn't been to before. So we're going to bring that to you at the start of the program, and then we're going to finish up with a yet another take on the importance of meat eating or the importance of vegetable eating or whatever it is, with a fascinating new book that just came out called The Butcher and the Vegetarian, but more about that when we get to that part of the program. The Stag's Leap District is a 3-square-mile area in a much larger wine-growing region, of course, called the Napa Valley, which has, it turns out, some very special properties. And we had the opportunity to record with several people who have different viewpoints and different parts of the Stag's Leap story. First of all, we're going to hear from the executive director of the Stag's Leap District Wine Growers Association, which has 19 members, all with parts of their vineyards in this 3-square-mile area called the Stag's Leap District. We're going to hear from her, first of all, about the special event and about Stag's Leap's background. And then right behind that, three winemakers from three of the top vineyards in the Stag's Leap area who presented a seminar in the morning of the event on the first day, and I captured them after their formal presentations are over, and I asked them a couple of simple questions about what it is that they thought that made Stag's Leap District wines different. So we're going to start with the Executive Director of the Wine Growers Association and then three of the top winemakers. Nancy Bialik is the Executive Director of the Stag's Leap Wine Growers Association. Sounds like quite a job, Nancy.
Well, thank you. I have I've been at it 14 years, so it's a wonderful little niche in the wine industry to be able to be the director of this association of 19 wineries.
And Stag's Leap stands for something pretty special in California, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is really synonymous, you know, top-notch, top-quality Cabernet Sauvignon, and that's what we grow here in the district. The district is planted to over 80% of Cabernet Sauvignon fruit, which does really well in this terroir and this climate here.
We just got done talking to somebody who said, now everybody thought you couldn't do that. Then, of course, you proved them wrong.
Yeah, it's been proved wrong for decades now. It was in the 70s that this area became critically acclaimed for their Cabernet due to the Judgment of Paris tasting, the famous tasting where the Stag's Leap wine cellars won top honors against top Bordeaux. And the media, of course, had this region pegged long before we became an official appellation by the BATF.
And we're here for a very special reason this evening, aren't we?
We are doing what we have colloquially call V2V, which stands for Vineyard to Vintner. And this is our flagship event of the year. We host hundreds of consumers in the district for an all-day session of open houses in which they can rub shoulders and hobnob and really have exclusive and backstage access to our vintners and our winemakers at their wineries and even their homes. And we culminate the evening with a dinner and dancing, and there's just a ton of camaraderie and just love of Cabernet and love of fine wine here.
How long has this event been on the calendar, and is it a certain time every year?
This particular event, I think we've been working on since the day after last year's, basically. This is our 10th year of hosting V2V, and we have tentative dates for next year already for the last Saturday in April, which is the weekend we have always done it. Next year, I believe that falls out on the 30th. Again, I caveat that. That's tentative. But we always hold it in late April. It seems to be a weekend where our vintners are in town and they're around, and they've come to know that they need to be here for this event, and they're here for their loyal fans and consumers.
And I noticed they're all setting up in the back. So in a large room that is like a storage room, there's more Stag's Leap wine than I'm going to be able to consume this evening. I think I'm going to have to be very selective, but they're all great, and I won't ask you to name which ones you think are the best, but perhaps you can let our listeners know a couple of your favorites.
Well, as the executive director, that's an incredibly political question, one I love to dodge regularly, and believe me, people call me all the time after they get our case of wine that we send out in October, we do a Appalachian collection where we've put together one bottle of wine from each of these wineries, and we send it out to consumers. And they're always calling me and say, "What should I open tonight, Nancy? And what do you like?" And I have to decline that question. But they're all fabulous. They all have their own in terms of wineries and principles, unique personalities. Small family wineries to larger wineries. But most important, they all have the Stag's Leap District characters, or the sort of the hallmarks of the region being soft, lush, very approachable wines with very soft tannins, very velvety fruit. And, you know, we line these wines up regularly when we taste them, and we're going to be tasting them tonight again as we taste through a preview of our Appalachian collection coming out in October. And what is remarkable, as we taste these flights of wines, people will say, "This one is delicious. Oh, this one's delicious. This one's delicious." And they go through the lineup. And so I have to say the same thing.
I'm going to suggest something. And then you can agree or disagree with me. And then I want you to conclude with a website, which I'm sure there is, to allow people to become involved, to get the annual collection, to be able to consider coming to this event. It seems these wines are, in a way, un-California. It's why they've been so successful in international competition. California is known so much for bold, brutish wines that don't necessarily go well with food. These do. What do you think?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, certainly these wines have evolved from the late 80s when people were making big tannic monster wines. And these wines just were not what was coming out of our terroir and out of the soils here. And these wines are incredibly elegant wines. They've got incredibly bright acidity, which really complements food. They are not hit you over the head wines, but they are incredibly full-bodied with very soft, round tannins. And please feel free to log on to our website at www.stagsleapdistrict.com. That's stagsleapdistrict.com. No apostrophe in the stags.
Well done, Nancy. Thank you so much. There's something about the Stag's Leap District in California where Peter is today representing On the Menu Radio, and we just sat through a seminar for an hour talking about what Stag's Leap is all about in the minds of three different vineyards. But I got the principals together. Three Stag's Leap District winemakers who I'm going to ask to answer two questions after they introduce themselves. First question is, what is it that makes Stag's Leap so special? After all, this is the California wine that won the Judgment of Paris twice. So there's clearly something going on here that's very unusual. And then I want them to say, now this is why I think my interpretation of Stag's Leap District is important. So first up...
Okay, I'm Elias Fernandez, winemaker at Schaefer Vineyards. So I believe the strength of the Stag's Leap District is due, one, to the soil types that we have here. Soils that are very old, of volcanic origin. And secondly, the microclimate within the Napa Valley. We have an influence of the San Pablo Bay near San Francisco, which brings winds here in the evenings and cools down the environment and allows for slow maturation of the grapes. So those two things are very, very important to stylistic, to the influence of the wines. And then the wines themselves are very dark, rich, elegant wines that age very nicely. They also reflect the people that work here. The people that work in these wineries are very elegant and self-spoken people themselves.
Hi, my name's Elizabeth Vianna. I'm the winemaker at Chimney Rock Winery, and I believe that there is truly a there when it comes to Stag's Leap District. Certainly the Paris tasting of 1976 showed the world that, but again, I think it's a combination of soil and the location within the Napa Valley, as Elias mentioned. I think the cooling of San Pablo Bay gives us a little bit of an edge on acidity, which to me is an incredibly important component for both ageability and balance in wines. And I think that's sort of the factor that is critical in Stag's Leap in many ways.
So that's, you call that the X factor. And you want a wine that has plenty of acidity. Okay, now let's see if we can find John here. John's doing autographs, but he's going to be here in just a second. And I may edit this part out, I may not, just depending on how long it lasts before he gets here.
Thank you, sir. My name is John Emmerich. I am the winemaker at Silverado Vineyards. And what I think makes our area so special, again, is this has been repeated three times or twice before, but again, it is the soil and it's the microclimate. It's just the fact that we are slightly cooler than a lot of our other neighbors, and that just gives the grapes time to ripen and respire a little bit in the evening. We get a large temperature shift, and I think that's one of the key things, again, about keeping structure within the grapes, not basically burning it out of them.
So there's some viticulture in here that you know just a little bit about, that's being added to what nature gives you. Now, it's really interesting because Cabernet Sauvignon is the principal grape, sometimes the exclusive grape in wines from Stag's Leap District. Yet the home of Cabernet Sauvignon in Europe is in a region that's much cooler than California. So what's the trick? What is it that California winemakers discovered that they said, well, I can make wines from this grape that goes in a much cooler region of the world?
I think what happened is originally, you know, we kind of looked to Bordeaux and tried to emulate them. And then at some point in time, we realized that obviously different growing conditions, but trying to find the right sites where we could get the expression of a sort of new world Cabernet with sort of the classic characters of the grape, and it's just trying to find that site.
Now, there are other countries, there are other areas of the world. Australia springs to mind, and perhaps Chile springs to mind as well, as areas where there is a warmer version, if you like, a warmer temperature version of Cabernet Sauvignon. Did you learn anything from them, or did you teach them something?
Well, you know, I don't think we're going to teach the Australians anything. and honestly, I would not say that Cabernet is a variety that they're going to rest their hat on. I mean, they have other varieties that are, I think, more successful, because I do think it is maybe a little too warm to be doing Cabernet. But again, in the right site, the right microclimate, they're going to be successful. And the same with Chile. I mean, in the right area, it's going to be fantastic.
Now let's see if we can get Leslie Zabraga, who's been on the program before. I'm going to have her wrap up. I'm also going to remind her what the questions were. What is it that makes Stag Leap so special? And then what about these particular wines as a representation of Stag's Leap? And then just a final thought for the day about this wonderful wine-growing region we both have the opportunity to visit. Leslie?
Well, I think what's so special about the district itself is that, number one, it's small. And I truly believe when you're talking about terroir and the expression of terroir, it's hard to say Bordeaux gives you this expression. It's easy to say this 1 mile by 3 mile piece of land has a true and unique character, and it really speaks through into the wine. And so I think Stag's Leap signature power wrapped in suppleness is what attracts everyone, and I think that the wines certainly that we showed today, the Silverado, the Chimney Rock, and the Schaefer, were very representative not only of the district itself, three various different parts of the district, but stylistically of the district, which runs from elegant to a little bit more masculine, you know. And I think that that's the beauty of the wines that we showed today.
Another question, it came up in the seminar we've been at, and it's really an interesting subject, the ageability of these wines. Whoever put the program together, if it was you, it was quite brilliant, set the same wines made by the same winemakers in a 99 vintage, which people might begin to think is the edge of California's ageability, and then an 05, which some people would suggest is way too young to be drinking. What do you think about those two things, Leslie?
Well, I think it was, the beauty of being able to put those together and look at, again, people think it's just tannins that age wine. It's not true at all. It's about the balance of the wine and that combination of tannins and acidity and everything else that goes into it. So by choosing a wine looking past into the past decade to a wine from the current decade, it allowed us to look at really a sense of the place, because you could see the common threads between these wines. And to see that, yes, guess what? These 99s were still youthful, very youthful in the glass. And Stag's Leap District wines do age very well. As we know by, of course, wineries like Stag's Leap Wine Cellars, which won the Paris tasting and produces some of the most long-lived wines in California, in my opinion. So I think that was the real beauty of showing the two vintages together.
Well, I thought it was brilliant. It was very enjoyable. Leslie, thank you so much. And our other winemakers have already gone off because they have other things to do, but we thank all of them too. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And now we need to take a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we want to take this opportunity to thank you for talking to us, even though it's mainly electronic, because you know this program started out as a real live talk radio show. Now we talk electronically, as I said. Anyhow, Peter's going to tell us more about his wine adventure. What's up next, Gravin?
Well, we got four very different stories about the Stag's Leap District. First of all, I had the chance to talk to the general manager of one of the top wineries in the Stag's Leap District and in California itself, Silverado. So that was an interesting take. And then a relatively new entrant into this marketplace, and from an unusual direction, a company called Terlato, T-E-R-L-A-T-O, which specializes in wine importing. And imports something like 1 in 7 wine bottles in the mid and premium price category into the United States, but recently started to get very interested in vineyards, and they have one called Chimney Rock, which is in the Stag's Leap District. So there are two, if you like, relatively corporate views. And then a fascinating interview with a guy who's like a Jim, like a, what's the Tony Soprano lookalike? He said once, in fact, I talked to him afterwards, after the interview, and he said somebody stopped him in the street in New York and asked him for his autograph. And he didn't have the heart to let them down, so he signed it Tony Soprano.
Oh, you're kidding.
And his family from the northern part of Italy, the Regussis, bought a ranch in the Stag's Leap District in 1932.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, because the Regussi would be a plural. No, it wouldn't be a plural of Ragusa.
Okay. Whatever.
But Ragusa is in Sicily.
Right, well, this is R-E-G anyway, so
okay.
It's Ragusi. And then the last one, a fascinating family that the father was best known for building the Transamerica Pyramid, a landmark building in San Francisco, but he also had a love of making wine, and that's what took him to the Stag's Leap District to make wine. And now his daughter or granddaughter, I forget which, is starting to make wine together with her children, and she's hoping that next generation will expand a winemaking operation from a really bootstrap start. So they're four very different views, but the same theme, that this is a really excellent wine-growing district with special character wines that you're going to want to know more about as you listen to these, and then you're going to want to go buy some, I'm sure. Isn't it fun to be in the Stag's Leap District? And we talked to the winemaker from Silverado earlier this morning, and I just now caught up with Russ Weiss, who's the manager, the general manager, the boss of Silverado, so I couldn't let it pass by the opportunity to bring him to your listeners. Russ, what's it like to be in the wine business at Silverado these days?
Well, it's always fantastic to be in the wine business. And it's funny that you should introduce me as the boss. What I always say is that I get to run Silverado the 10% of the time that it's not running me. But what's it like being in the wine business these days? It's difficult. Obviously, it's more difficult to be in the restaurant business. And so many of our customers are restaurateurs, and obviously we feel for them, and we hope they recover quickly so that everybody gets to back to enjoying the great things in life.
In just a few words, what would you say Silverado stands for and the Stag's Leap District stands for?
Well, with Silverado, it's really easy. Ron and Diane Miller, our owners, came to the Valley in the early 70s and started out as grape growers. They didn't build the winery until 1981. Over the, you know, obviously our home is in Stag's Leap. That's where our heart is, and that's where our first vineyard was, and that's where the winery is. But over the years, Ron and Diane have collected an estate that now is 6 vineyards, 400 acres, all around the valley, Carneros, Atlas Peak, Coombsville, Stag's Leap, Yountville. And if we're about anything, it's about being a great estate winery.
So you get to run all of those?
Yeah, that's right, all of those. And that's really fun because really most of what we do at the winery is farming most of the year. And that's my background anyway. I grew up, I'm fourth generation California farmer, grape grower, in fact, and my dad's still down in the Central Valley growing grapes. So for me, it's like being home. And you said, you asked, I'll answer the second part of the question, what's it mean to be in Stag's Leap? And it's such a special site for these wonderful silky textures that Cabernet develops here. And we feel very privileged to have one of the, you know, to be in one of the great neighborhoods for Cabernet.
To begin with, I guess, growing Cabernet in this area was considered something of a risk because people thought you couldn't grow it south of Rutherford. I mean, somebody told me Warren Winarski was the guy who first said, that's rubbish, I know I can do it. So when did you catch on to that?
That's actually terrific. You know, Warren purchased Nathan Fay's vineyard. It was really Nathan Fay, the first farmer in this valley who put Cabernet in. It was lovely to be able to actually meet him. And I remember asking him, well, Nathan, you know, you're such a pioneer. What a bold move. You know, as UC Davis was telling everybody that Stag's Leap had to be, you know, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and perhaps Riesling. What a bold, visionary thing for you to do. He said, it wasn't visionary at all. Bob Mondavi was running around telling people he was going to pay a lot of money for Cabernet. So I thought, well, I better put some Cabernet in. So he was really our pioneer with Dick Stelzner and a few other folks.
So the first thing was growing grapes for somebody else. And then after that, you said, well, what? That's kind of a silly idea. Why don't we make our own wines?
And that's certainly true of Ron and Diane. They purchased our ranch from Harry C., who, if any of your listeners are out in the West Coast, they'll know that's our great chocolatier, Mary C., a little white box with a little, yeah. So Harry was the grandson of Mary, and he was the guy that put Cabernet in a couple of years after Nathan, you know, put his in. And Ron and Diane just the vineyard from him. And, of course, they were selling, you know, here we are in this lovely spot in Clos de Vaux. They were selling wines to Clos de Vaux and a few other folks. And those wines were starting to get some real attention. And that gave Ron and Diane the idea they ought to be trying to do it on their own.
Well, we wish you continued success with the Silverado story. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this evening.
What a great pleasure. Thanks so much.
Vice President of Winemaking sounds like a pretty big job. Douglas Fletcher from Toletto Vineyards and Chimney Rock.
Well, it is. It's the old joke about be careful what you ask for, you might get it. I was originally the winemaker at Chimney Rock, and when the Toletto family bought Chimney Rock back in 2001, I was still the winemaker there, and Tony Toletto, the owner or president, asked me if I could help him with his other properties as well. So that's how I got to be eventually the VP of winemaking for all of the Toletto family wineries.
Of all those properties, would you say Stag's Leap's my favorite?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's where I started, and I do think it's the world's best place to grow Cabernet Sauvignon. I mean, there's, I don't know, other people have talked about this, but, you know, clearly the tasting in Paris 30 years ago was really not only launched Stag's Leap District, it really launched Napa Valley as a premier wine growing region. And that tasting has been repeated every decade since then. And it's always been the Stag's Leap Winery wine that's either won or this last time, all of the California wines actually came in before the French wines. But Stag's Leap always comes to the top on all these tastings. And in fact, actually, here a few years ago, the Wine Spectator had 60% of the Stag's Leap District wineries in the top 50, and there's no other appellation in the world that's ever done that.
I was talking to Nancy, the executive director of your grape growing association, just a little bit ago, and I suggested to her that the wines from this district seem to be almost un-California like.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's I think they're somewhat unique in that they've got very berry-like qualities to them, but they don't tend to be particularly tannic. They've got a really smooth, velvety character to them, and I think that's what makes us unique. If you look at Bordeaux, you don't see that kind of character, and even up valley here in Napa Valley, you know, if you taste Rutherford Cabs or Howell Mountain Cabernet, they're just not like Stag's Leap. In fact, actually, as my in my capacity as VP of winemaking, I oversee several other wineries, Rutherford Hill being one of them, and we there make wines from a lot of different parts of the valley. And I'm not sure that I would always be able to taste a blind taste wines and say, oh, this is from one region or another. But I think the grapes are quite distinctive. And I'm not sure I could say that these are Rutherford grapes, but I'm pretty sure I could say that these are Stag's Leap grapes.
Terlato is an unusual wine organization because it's owned by one man and his family, but it's really quite big and spans the globe as well as California. Can you introduce us briefly to the whole portfolio of wines that you're responsible for?
Well, Terlato Wines International is the parent company. I work for an offshoot of that called Terlato Wine Group, which is really the wineries that they own. But the bigger company is a major importer of wines. They import one bottle out of every seven, I believe, that's over $14 a bottle. So they're really in the fine wine business. They're not in the volume business, but the fine wine business. So they bring in wines like Two Hands from Australia, Jos Meyer from the Alsace, Chapoutier from the Rhone, Bollinger from Champagne, Angelo Gaia from Piedmonte. So they really have a wonderful portfolio of wines. And about 15 years ago or so, they started buying wineries in California. Rutherford Hill was the first one they bought back in 96. And then Chimney Rock in 2001. And then Alderbrook the year after that. And then just recently, Sanford Winery down on the Central Coast. And I'm really excited about that project as well because we're really focusing on Pinot Noir and Chardonnay down there, and it's a really wonderful area for it. And even more recently, they bought the old Sanford and Benedict Vineyard, which is right adjacent to the winery. So I've got a lot of things on my plate. I guess I still think that Chimney Rock is really my favorite place.
And isn't that Michael Twelvetree from Two Hands? Isn't he just a blast?
Oh, he is. He's bigger than life.
He told me that he went around Australia telling Australian winemakers they didn't know how to make wine. And of course, since he had a strong background in the construction industry, he would change that. he came to Pittsburgh and we met him there. So he's certainly a larger than life character. But in your own way, I think you're a larger than life character too, don't you think? Don't you sometimes scratch yourself and say, I need to wake up and realize where I am?
Well, I don't know. I'm having fun. I guess I don't always, think about all those little things. You're just in the moment, I suppose. My real love is what we're doing in the vineyard. So right now is a very busy time for me. I think that most high quality wines are made in the vineyard from pruning decisions up through veraison. And if you haven't gotten it right then, it's kind of too late. So a lot of people, I think of great wines being made by picking decisions, and it's not really that. I think it's all the things that go on in the vineyard from bud break to, to veraison.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us. The event is getting underway, so Doug, I guess we better go taste some wine.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it as well. Thank you.
I'm sitting in the shade at the Ragushi Winery in the Stag's Leap District in California, talking to Jim, who runs this business now for his family. But it's been in your family, Jim, for a long time. Let us know how things got started at Ragushi.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for having me, and I'm speaking with you. The way Ragushi got started, if I'll go back to the original, is my grandfather purchased this ranch. We're in what's known today as the heart of the Stag's Leap District. The home ranch consists of 280 acres, 160 of them planted to grapes. So we're pretty fortunate. Unbeknownst to he bought in the middle of this, what turned into be the Stag's Leap District. So he came here when he was 13, 1907, purchased it, did what every farmer did in this time as he grew up, farmed cattle, prunes, corn, a lot of livestock. Then as kind of the evolvement of Napa Valley came, 1970, by that time my father had taken over the home ranch, always a grape grower, always livestock producer in that. This ranch on it, besides having a winery at the time, was built 1878, was the original building of the winery. It's one of the last few ghost wineries left in the valley. It was my grandfather, when he purchased it, it was abandoned at the time. My dad never made wine. My family has never made commercial wine. And then we were always grateful growers and farmers. And then I started a farming company in 85 as I graduated high school. And that farming company only farmed grapes, farmed a little over 2,000 acres here in Napa, from smaller producers up to real large producers. And then 96 was when I decided I wanted to start the winery side. So as far as reconditioning, bringing back the buildings and that type of thing, it wasn't a huge problem because most of our buildings were up to, as far as it goes, the big buildings, 3 foot or 2.5 foot thick walls, all below ground. Clos du Vall had started here in 1970, so we have a lot of pre-uses. So for me to start the winery side, it wasn't a real big issue.
But you were good at growing grapes. You were good at farming. What made you think that you might be good at making wine?
I don't know if there was ever a thought that we'd be good at it or what it was. It was kind of just a natural progression for me to go on to the next step of being a wine, producing wine and going full circle on the wine side.
Now, you didn't just start making any old wine. I mean, this is Ragushi wine is very well respected. Tell us about some of that recognition. It's not a name that I must confess is familiar to me, Peter, but then I don't have a budget for Stegsley District wines a lot of the time. But you were just in a competition of 100 best Cabernets, and you came close to winning that. Tell us about some of the other awards you've received, Jim.
Yeah, what you're speaking of was the top 100 cabs of Napa Valley. We were, I believe, 2 and 4 in that. And then also we... another brand in our district was Brian Mock, and that received number 12 or 15, and that was grown off of this ranch. Awards-wise, point-wise, and scores, I've never really gone after them. Don't submit to them. Most of our wines that you will see here are all produced off of they're all estate wines, sell everything pretty much direct. We only do about 6,000 cases of Ragushi on the production side of that. I do produce some other wines that are non-Stag's Leap, though. Those, I have a company called Nine North Wines. James Harder has a winery down the road, and Jim Gill, a friend of mine. We started a company. We do produce about 100,000, 120,000 cases of that. We run it under a company called Nine North, and these gentlemen are good marketing guys, and they both have their own wine brands. James has his own winery. And they kind of started out like I did with not a lot and just kind of grew from there. And what we do on those wines is these are wines that I'm connected to that we grow across the state, across Napa County, Solano County, and Alameda County. And it just didn't make sense. I had saw so many good wines going to the bulk market. So we just started, producing those wines ourselves. So none of those are produced here. Ragushi's 100% estate. Only Ragushi is produced at Ragushi. The other wines we produce at other wineries.
Now, are you the winemaker, Jim, or did you bring someone on board to do that?
No, to be honest with you, I'm not the winemaker. And when you say bring someone on board, my winemaker came on board with me from day one is Charles Hendricks. And he also has his brand called Hope and Grace. And then, to be honest, that's how I ended up teaming up with James Harder and for the marketing side. I only knew I had a winemaker. I know how to grow grapes. Don't understand marketing at all. My marketing was pretty simple. And it's always, I guess I was kind of lucky. I didn't even need to know marketing for this because we still sell everything direct out of here for the most part. So when he came, we were just making wine and growing grapes, making wine. But what ended up happening is I was smart enough to know what blocks to take to make wine out of. So over the years, when I first started, I was able to pull blocks away. I asked Dan Duckhorn at the time if I could take some of his stuff back under contract. We had Duckhorn. We had a lot of stuff going into what's now the Insignia label. Inglenook at the time in its heyday. We were their base block wines. So it wasn't that difficult to know. Every vineyard has a sweet spot. I don't care if it's a 10-acre piece of property, a 100-acre piece of property. Those are the areas you look for to produce wine out of.
So they're the blocks in this property that you're using for Ragushi wines?
Correct. For Ragushi, I'll still sell probably about 85% off on grape side. I'll never grow over 7,000, 8,000 cases, the top amount of wine we'll ever make on that brand of Stag's Leap. And the thing is, we have a brand, it's just my philosophy is we have a brand that we make called Angelo's. I named after my father. That is a reserve wine, very expensive wine. And since 96, I've only made it five times because not every year, nature doesn't provide every year a wine that takes a caliper as a vineyard designate or even a reserve wine. You can't have a reserve program just because you want a reserve program. The wines have to stand out and be different every single year.
Now, we listeners, you'll remember a past interview with the family which owns Château Beaucastel, and they make a wine in honor of the person who really set the modern tradition for the winery, and they only make it once every four or five years if the fruit just happens to be good enough to do that. We were at Tablas Creek in Paso Robles just very recently, and apparently their intention is to do the same thing in honor of the Perrin family and their investment in this whole thing. But the idea is just as you described it, that if you've got really special fruit, then you want to recognize your past and honor that by making a very special wine, but not just turning it out just because you have to. In that particular case, one particularly, I think it was 2002, they did not make any Château Beaucastel Class 1 wine at all because the vintage was a disaster, and they decided rather than make a poor relative Beaucastel, they wouldn't make any at all. So it all went into their second wine. So I'm guessing that what you're saying is the same thing.
It's close to the same thing, yes. It's very close to the same thing. But what ends up happening, even on a vintage that the writers and the kind of the media in that panned the 98 vintage of California. 98 we've made some good wines. Actually, we don't do the rating thing much, but we got rated by Parker this year. Somehow we got into the Parker ratings, and they were 94 to 96s with them. We did well. But still, to this day, I think probably one of my best wines I've ever made is a 98. So within every year, even though it's a hard growing year and a vintage, if kind of, for lack of a better term, if they pan a vintage, there are good producers and good wines made out of that year.
And they actually did the same to the 2000 vintage as well. And those of us who had confidence in Napa bought a lot of 2000, so it's the best year represented in our cellar at home for just that reason. And I tasted the 98 Ragushi with Jim just earlier, and it's really a splendid wine. We had the 98. The bottle we had, it was a little funky. Tasted delightful, but you were going to decant it, and maybe you'll bring some tonight.
I'll bring another bottle because I'm sure we'll drink that one by the end of the day. But it did need to be decanted. We opened that wine and went right to pouring it. You're right, though. It was a 98. I didn't even think about that till right now.
This is a fascinating man, listeners. Before we came on the air, Jim was telling me about his first paid job. Jim, why don't you tell me the story and then finish up with your Charlie Trotter story.
Oh, okay. First time I was ever paid, actually, what we're speaking of, we were talking earlier, is I grew up with a Swiss-Italian family. My mom and dad, my aunt and uncle, we're all Swiss-Italian. And, you know, being Italian kids, you farm or you work, and you're just expected to do it. It's part of what you do. I was pulling prune trees out on this ranch for my dad. I was probably about 10 years old. I was stacking prune trees to burn. And Nathan Fay next door. Well, that also helped us with Nathan, that vineyard with Winarski won the Paris tasting with it. That's the next door piece. So asked me to come over there and pull some fruit trees out. And those times, a lot of prune trees. So I went over, pulled them, stacked them, and he paid me. And that was actually the first time I ever realized that you got paid to farm or paid to work. So then, you know, I kind of realized downstream that I'd start a farming company. What you're speaking of Charlie Trotters, when you're speaking of quality and that, I went into Charlie Trotters one time. I was on a road trip, and I had joined the Napa Valley Vintners, and then I went there, and that's where one of the places in Chicago that we actually placed our wine, the young lady, I can still remember her name, was Belinda. I don't even know if she's still there, but she'd been there a long time. I watched them, because of the fact of our livestock side, I watched them bring in lambs into the restaurant. They brought lambs in, full carcasses, cut probably 6 to 8 chops out of them, and sent the rest of them back. Because the thinking was, that was the first time I had ever met him, and the thinking was, you know, we're taking the very best of this, nothing more. And I was just amazed by that. And, you know, it's kind of the same thing no matter what you do in agriculture. There's a sweet spot in everything, whether it be grapes, whether it be lamb, whether it be whatever. And that the best raw product will produce the best finished product.
Well, that certainly happens here at Ragushi. Jim, I'm so glad that we had the chance to talk with you and get your wonderful story, and we wish you continued success, which I'm sure you're going to have. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. So thank you, and I enjoyed listening to your show online. Thank you.
I have a question for you, listeners, and you'll never get it right. What's the connection between the Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco a landmark everyone must recognize, and a winery in Stags Leap District. Well, Janice Ilsley can answer that question for us. Janice?
My grandfather built the Transamerica building, Ernie Ilsley, and also planted Cabernet Sauvignon right around that time in the Stags Leap District.
That was quite a leap in the dark, wasn't it, at the time, because it was considered not good, not a good area for that grape?
My grandfather and Robert Mondavi were dear friends, and they were in San Francisco at Trader Vic's, the restaurant, very famous restaurant in those days. And Robert thought that there'd be money to be made in the Stags Leap District if one was to plant a Cabernet.
So Robert wasn't always right. He certainly was right on that one, huh?
Yes, indeed.
Now, fast forward over the decades since 1964. What's been happening with Ilsley over that time frame?
Ilsley Vineyards grew grapes for the Robert Mondavi Winery for 47 years. And in 2000, my brothers came to me. We're the third generation to grow grapes on the property. And we began making Ilsley Vineyards Cabernet Sauvignon. We make 500 cases. Currently, we sell to our neighbors, the Schaefer family.
When you say you sell to them, you sell them grapes?
We sell 90% of the fruit that's grown on the property to John Schaefer, Schaefer Vineyards.
Well, he's a good customer, and he's making great wine. I tasted some of it this morning, and I guess we're about to taste some more of it now. But what's in the future for Ilsley? Will you make more wine, Janice, do you think?
As my daughter just turned 21, the fourth generation of Ilsley Vineyards, we're hoping that they will take our small production of 500 cases, build a winery on the property, and continue to grow. We'd like to keep the ranch in the family. I would love to see my grandchildren have a viable business.
That's a wonderful thought on which to end a series of interviews that we've made about the Stags Leap District. Is there anything really additional you'd like to say, Janice, before we go taste some wine?
Cheers.
Cheers indeed, and off we go.
And now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and after all that wine, we're now lurching into a different direction altogether.
Aren't we? And this is a totally fascinating interview, a personal story, if you like, a food chemical story. It contains one fascinating thing that I've been talking about for years and years and years. People talk about being vegetarians because they don't want to cause pain to animals.
Oh, rabbit.
But the author of this book and our interview subject said that it had been discovered, something I've thought all along, that in fact vegetables might have brains and might feel pain too. And apparently it's been proven according to experiments.
That's the point of this book, however.
Carrots feel pain too. Well, no, I know, but it's just a really interesting note.
Different issues to deal with.
So just be careful. Just be careful what you wish for.
And her book is entitled "The Butcher and the Vegetarian," and she's not a butcher, but she encountered butchers. And let us just hear her tale of her trial, and we can't tell you what she ended up eating. But anyhow, let's go with the interview. You're going to have to buy the book to find out what she's doing now.
Well, I never thought that a book discussing the pros and cons of meat eating and vegetarianism and whatnot would be a page turner, but this book is. Tara Austin Weaver, you've done a page turner of an issue book, and that's a major thing. It's called The Butcher and the Vegetarian, and everybody wants to read it to the end to find out what happened, but we're not going to tell exactly that yet, okay?
But I think if you're a cow or a sheep or a chicken, it's probably a page turner anyway, right? Do you have one of those little the cows from Chick-fil-A, which says eat more chicken?
No, I don't.
you should undoubtedly get one of those.
It's pretty cute. Yeah, Tara, this is a hybrid book, as you described it, part memoir, part what?
Well, there's some journalism aspects to it. Once I tried to figure out, you know, whether I'd been raised vegetarian, and so questions about if I was going to meat, how was that meat raised? You know, of course, the Michael Pollan book had come out around the time that I was working on this project, so I was was very interested in, you know, where the meat was coming from, and so I went and spent some time on some sustainable ranches and interviewed ranchers. That's sort of the journalism side of it.
Yeah, and Taryn, to just sort of summarize the plot here, because it seems to be there is a plot. You were raised very strictly vegetarian, and actually you didn't like being different so much, did you?
No, I grew up in the 70s and early 80s, and at that time it was very unusual to be vegetarian. Even in Northern California, where we were living, it was really a very odd choice at the time, and there weren't. And I went to other people's houses, they all ate meat, and when I watched TV, which we actually weren't allowed to watch at home, but saw commercials, it was all, you know, families were sitting down to meals that looked very different than the meals that my family sat down to. So I always sort of felt like I was on the outside and different.
But that was not why you started exploring what you should eat. You had health issues.
I did. About 6-7 years ago, I started feeling ill and went to a variety of doctors, and no one really knew what the answer was for me. And finally, sort of in desperation, a friend of mine recommended her acupuncturist, Chinese medicine doctor, and I thought, you know, at this point, what do I have to lose? So I went, and the acupuncturist gave me herbs and told me to steep it in chicken stock and sent me packing off to a butcher shop to find...
You know, I mean, I can imagine, even though I was raised eating meat, some butcher shops can really be kind of scary, especially if the old-fashioned kind with things just sort of naked on a counter.
And this butcher shop in particular is thought to be the oldest operating, continuously operating butcher shop in all of California.
Uh-huh.
So it's very, very traditional. And I found that it just is like walking into a foreign culture.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a language that I don't speak, and there are just, you know, knowledge that I didn't have. And it was all very intimidating to me as well. And these sort of swashbuckling butchers that are throwing big hunks of raw meat around. It was a very, very different place than I had been raised with.
Now, the title of it, The Butcher and the Vegetarian, is a sort of a generalization of the issues.
It is. I mean, it started...
I mean, there's not a particular butcher, huh?
No. It started at this one butcher shop, and one of the butchers there at one point actually, offered to, when I explained to him that I had been raised vegetarian and that large pieces of meat scare me, he was, you know, very, very kind, and he said, well, you know, I can give you tips if you want to learn, And he sort of challenged me to learn how to cook everything in the butcher counter, which I didn't actually do because there are things in there that I just don't like. But that sort of started me off on the journey, and from there spent time with charcuterie makers and ranchers and cowboys and barbecue masters. And so there isn't, you know, everyone wants to know, do you end up marrying a butcher?
That would be funny, wouldn't it?
that doesn't happen. But there are a number of butchers and other... The world of meat is a very masculine world, so there are all of these sort of fascinating male characters that I came across.
And this explains the subtitle of your book, One Woman's Romp Through a World of Men, Meat, and Moral Crisis.
Yes.
Right. Well, you know, we were just in Paso Robles, and we interviewed, actually, a cowboy. I didn't know the cowboys existed. I'm Northeast. But there were real cowboys.
Yeah, they do exist. They really do.
And they wear those hats and they wear the boots, and right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I got to spend some time on ranches, and it's funny. I mean, I just sort of assumed that a lot of the world of, you know, meat raising had been very mechanized, but really, it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's a lot of hard work being out there in the fields and with the animals. It hasn't really changed. I mean, there's a lot of technology that they use now in terms of, you know, breeding selection, and they track the animals through computers. But at the end of the day, it's a man or a woman raising an animal.
And you were on the kill floor. Who did we interview, Rabbit, about some woman who worked her way through butchering?
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. I have a different question.
And oh, yeah?
Anne thinks this is a silly question. But I want to understand why it's all right to eat cauliflowers and it's all right to eat green beans as if they don't have brains and they don't have any feeling when you cut them off the plant or you pull them out of the ground. I mean, what is it about vegetables that makes it open season on vegetables but close season on meat?
That's a good question. You know, it's interesting. One of the ranches that I visited, Prather Ranch in Northern California,
right,
they started raising sustainable organic meat back in the 70s, back before anyone was interested in this stuff. And they actually had a hard time marketing it at first, and they tried to get into the farmers markets that were just popping up around that time. And the markets weren't interested because a lot of them had come, you know, developed out of the vegetarian movement, and they were very vegetable-centric. And they told me that they finally were accepted in the Berkeley, California farmers market because a study came out that showed that actually carrots do feel pain.
Oh, no.
When they are harvested. So this was a way for them to sort of wrap their head around the idea of allowing meat.
There you go. See, I knew I was right. I hate to be right, but I am right just every once in a while. But it's only carrots. Green beans don't feel a thing.
Well, and it's interesting because there are certainly there are religions that are vegetarian entirely, and I think the line that they draw is this whole idea of a sentient being.
Mm-hmm.
An animal could, I mean, we assume, I suppose, that they have thoughts. We don't really know. But I know that for some people that's where the line is drawn. Or mammals, or, you know, animals who care for their young, or, you know. It's really, I mean, we put a lot of humanistic behavior on animals.
Oh, we do indeed, yeah.
No, I know you had a variety of, if you like, barriers to cross. not just in looking at real animals, but also in looking at products derived from animals, which are perhaps not immediately appetizing. And I remember the Boudin Noir story.
Yes.
Now, I don't remember the details exactly, but you decided that wasn't entirely approachable?
Well, I had spent an afternoon with the charcuterie makers of the Fatted Calf, which is a fantastic sort of artisanal, handmade charcuterie company in Northern California. And they're just wonderful, wonderful people, and they're working really hard to source their meat responsibly. And, you know, one of the reasons why they're really drawn to charcuterie is that it uses all of the bits of the animal that America,
right,
a lot of times,
yeah,
that,
otherwise
it, now, but
yeah, they get thrown on the kill, they get thrown on the kill, they drop on the kill floor and they're thrown away.
Yeah, for years there was a lot of waste because there wasn't interest in that. So they really want to, you know, if you're going to be using animal products, they really want to make use of everything. And in theory, this is a philosophy I absolutely support. And I had watched them make a number of products that day, but one of the things that they were making was this blood sausage. And as you said, Boudin Noir. And then that weekend, I went to the farmer's market, and I was so excited to actually purchase the sausage I'd watched them make, because they're so passionate about what they're doing, and you know, they really do. Everything is just made by hand, and I'd been able to witness that, and it was really moving. So I was very excited to buy this sausage, and I got it home, and you know, it's actually been boiled, so it really does turn quite a dark color. It's not red, blood red anymore. But it was a little intimidating because I wasn't sure how to cook it properly, and you know, in my head, I knew that it had already been boiled, so it wasn't like I was going to, you know, run risk of giving myself food poisoning if I undercooked it. But yeah, the preparation was really intimidating, and then when I actually sat down to eat it, it was, you know, I sort of went through a process of kind of developing, you know, a tolerance to dealing with all of the food items. And at that point in my evolution, that was a bit further than I had managed to screw my courage up. So
now,
I ended up giving it to a chef that I know, because I knew that he would appreciate it and prepare it well and enjoy it, and I certainly wasn't going to let it go to waste. But at that point, I was still in the, you know, in the kiddie pool, really.
Now, have you had a partner in these adventures? I didn't read the book all the way through, unlike
Anne.
So
I had a lot of people take me under their wing, which was really lovely. And one of the things that I hadn't really anticipated or understood is how much there are many people that really love meat in this way that, obviously, from my background, I don't share that passion. But for so many people, meat holds such traditions and such memories and cultural significance. And, you know, whether it's the specific holidays that you have.
Yeah, I loved your stories of the Thanksgiving turkeys.
Yeah, Thanksgiving turkeys or Easter ham or summer barbecues. And, you know, I have a good friend of mine who grew up, her family, you know, for every sort of celebration or family birthday, they would either go to a steakhouse or her grandmother would cook steak and the whole family would come together. So she has these really warm, fuzzy memories of steakhouses, which, you know, I come to it as an adult and I go, God, that's a lot of money for a meal that, you know, for me personally, isn't as exciting as some other really high-end meals where chefs are being wildly, you know, creative. I mean, it's, you know, a steak dinner hasn't really evolved all that much. So, you know, it's interesting to enter this world where people do feel very strongly about it, and so many of them really enjoyed indoctrinating me and sharing their passion and their love.
I think it was sort of a religious thing. They thought they were saving you.
They're saving my soul, converting at last.
Yeah, you mentioned so many people that are also friends of ours, like David Kitch and Chris Costantino.
Yeah.
I wouldn't turn down a hunk of roasted pig from David Kitch.
Oh, you know, when this Michelin starred chef is holding out like the, you know, the best part of the pig and telling you to taste it, like, yeah, you're going to taste. I mean, at least I'm going to taste it. I know. I mean, I don't want to make light of vegetarianism or vegetarians because people feel very, very strongly, and it's you know, it is a challenging choice to make. It's gotten much easier, but I grew up in the 70s and 80s with my mother, who's a staunch vegetarian, and it was difficult. I mean, there were certain restaurants that I remember, actually, it was sometime in the early 80s, she discovered that the Lark Creek Inn, which at the time was, yeah, you know, a very, very well-known and beloved restaurant in Northern California, that they didn't have a vegetarian item on the menu, but you could order just a plate of grilled vegetables, and they would make it for you. Mm-hmm. And this actually allowed her to go to this very, you know, this upscale restaurant that she had never been able to go to because they didn't really, you know, cater to people who had decided not to eat meat.
Right. Of course, nowadays,
I have a tremendous amount of respect for people who choose to go in that direction. But in
nowadays, though, everybody needs to be accommodated. I think that the wheels turned. I think.
Well, you know, it's interesting because growing up in Northern California, I would say, you know, I mean, so many of the people I know there are vegetarian. But now I spend a lot of time in Seattle, and the restaurants, the upscale restaurants in Seattle, I mean, they probably have about one vegetarian item on the menu, but you sort of have to be in the mood for that one item.
Tara, why do you spend half your time in San Francisco and half the, you know, Tara is one of my Twitter buddies, and
I'm always confused
as to why she seems reluctant to be leaving one place and going to the other.
Because I can't choose between two such amazing cities. I'm from Northern California, and I grew up there, and my roots run deep, and I have, you know, tremendous friends, and I love what's happening there, particularly in the food world. It's very, you know, you sort of feel like you're on the cutting edge of especially the sustainable food movement. But my family is all entirely in Seattle now, and I love this city as well. And in some ways, it actually reminds me of the San Francisco that I grew up with.
It's, you know, it's probably because it's smaller and slower.
I really like that. I mean, I find that my time down in the Bay Area is very busy and running around, and it's really fun. And then I come back to Seattle, and I sort of get my rhythm back, and I go for walks, and I garden, and I go kayaking on the lakes in the summer, and it's a really, really amazing, wonderful place.
I think a lot of people in Seattle who used to live in Seattle before California invaded probably think the reason it feels a lot like California is it's got more Californians in it than San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, it's been interesting. You know, I went to college in Washington, and at that time, you know, in the past 15 years, Seattle has really changed and become much more a city of people who didn't necessarily grow up here. I mean, not entirely. There are a lot of very, very proud natives that love it here, but, you know, with Microsoft, it's brought a lot of people from other countries
right.
as well.
Oh, sure. I'm sure it has.
Now, I asked you a question I don't think we ever resolved before we even came on the air, is at what point did you actually decide that your experience was going to be in a book?
Well, it's interesting. The book was not my idea.
Now, you were a blogger.
I had been a writer before I was a blogger, but I had never written about food. I had written about travel a lot, which, you know, food is a component of travel, obviously. But I had written about travel and culture and art. And it was only when I got sick, which, you know, it's sort of where the book starts, is with me getting sick, that I was really bored. I was home for a long period of time because I felt really, really unwell and wasn't able to work. And I had started reading all of these food blogs, and I was just fascinated by these people who were so passionate about food and cooking and flavor. And I mean, I had all of those feelings as well. I just never really ever thought to write about them. So on a whim, one day, I started a food blog, and I never put my name on it. I didn't want any of my writing colleagues or editing clients to ever find it, and I didn't tell anyone about it for the longest time. But I just started, you know, I thought I'd keep it up for maybe 2 weeks, and then I'd go back to work and forget about it. But I really loved writing about food, and it sort of fused my, you know, my passion for writing and my passion for cooking together, and it was really, really enjoyable writing. So I kept it up, and I guess about 3 months into that, I had a friend of mine who's a literary agent saw a piece that I had written. It was actually about Irish soda bread, but the soda bread was being sold at this butcher shop, and so I had to walk in there. And she had known that I was sort of trying to eat meat. And when she read this piece and I mentioned my fear of butcher shops, she said, "That's what you should be writing about." And I said, "Absolutely not. I'm never going to write about meat." But the twists and turns of my life went forward. It seemed like everything, you know, all of the doctors were telling me to eat meat. And at one point I went to a doctor who ran some allergy tests on me and told me that I had to cut out of my diet all dairy and eggs and beans because I had, you know, allergic, not really allergies, but intolerant reactions to these food things. My body wasn't processing them well. So at that point, you know, my only protein source that was left really was meat. And that was the point where I thought, okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to write this book because, you know, everything is pushing me in this one direction, so I might as well just go for it.
Well, we have arrived at that point where I think we can reveal the outcome.
Yeah, because the ending is just a little unexpected.
Well, and I actually don't like to talk about it all that much, because if people haven't read the book, I like them to be able to discover it on their own.
Okay, so we're not going to mention it.
But I will absolutely say that it was a complete shock and surprise to me, but, you know, sort of the course of the story took me to a place that I hadn't planned on going, and it wasn't really the ending that I had intended to write. I actually had to ring my editor up at one point and say, you know, I'm really sorry, but I think we might have a new ending. Is this okay? And she thought it was really funny, actually.
Oh, I thought it was a brilliant move. I never expected
but,
it.
But we're not going to. But no, we're not going to say what
we're
it is.
We're not going to say what it is. So everybody will have to go get this book.
Well, and it's what I think is so interesting is that everyone wants to know the ending, and the meat eaters sort of want to think that, you know, you couldn't possibly taste bacon and then give it up. You know, it's one thing to not be raised with it because you know, you didn't get a chance. You didn't get a fair chance.
Yeah.
But now that you've experienced this, could you possibly walk away from it? And the vegetarians don't want to think that, you know, meat could restore you to health because, I mean, they're perfectly healthy and fine and they don't eat meat. So, you know, but it's just interesting to me because everyone else, it's like my personal decision for whatever is going to happen in my life is going to say something about other people's decisions. And I really, at the end, I think, I mean, I hope I explained it well enough in the book, that I really think that people need to come to their own solutions for their own life and their you know, even their body. I think everyone's physiology is different, and what I eat to make me feel good is not necessarily going to be the same thing that either of you need to eat.
Yeah, well, I think that is clear.
Yeah, I have no idea what Anne's going to request after this, because she only just finished a book just before the interview came on the air.
But I'm going to say that the people who read this, pick up this book, will also find that you have the most winsome sense of humor, and it runs all the way through this book, even though the subject is fairly serious. So I enjoyed it thoroughly.
That's very sweet of you to say. I think in deciding to write the book, which again hadn't really been on my to-do list, I wanted to write a book that's maybe talked about some of the political issues, but did so in a way that was approachable and human, because I feel like the whole eat meat or not eat meat, the whole conversation gets very, very intense sometimes. And, you know, people have very strong feelings and come at it from a very different angle than, you know, most people, I'd say 99.9% of the world, because I was born into vegetarianism. It's not something that I chose for myself. And I really, you know, was raised very far from the meat-eating world. So for me, I sometimes when I walk into the butcher shop, I sort of felt like I was sort of like Jane Goodall observing the carnivores in their native environment because it was just so, you know, so foreign. But, you know, I hopefully it's a book that will make, you know, amuse people and also make them think a little bit.
Oh, this is such a worthwhile book to explore, listeners. Again, it's now Tara Austin Weaver, Butcher and the Vegetarian. And to find out what happens, go get it now. Tara, thank you so much.
Oh, thank both of you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and we'll talk again next
I hope so. Take care.
Thanks, Tara.
Well, I'm afraid we've left you with, in the jargon, a cliffhanger. But
have we just?
Yeah, but you will just love this book. It's, as I said, on this kind of a subject, you don't expect to encounter a page turner, but I couldn't put it down.
Yeah, I know. So. She read this one from cover to cover, and you'll want to do the same thing. Now, it's the James Beard Awards tomorrow evening. On the menu will be there. We hope to capture some of the personalities who are there, some of the people who won awards, and find out how they are excited about it. And with any kind of luck, we'll bring you some of those interviews in next week's program. But until then,
bye-bye.